Hey there. This is a joint podcast between the Vassals of Kingsgrave and the Bastards of Kingsgrave. In this episode, we review two stories from George R.R. Martin's Thousand Worlds setting. If you would like to hear our previous reviews of Martin's short fiction, you can find them on the BOK podcast feed and the VOK YouTube channel. If you would like to read the stories, most of them are available in Martin's 2003 collection entitled Dream Songs.
Welcome back as we continue our longest-running reread of George R. R. Martin's earlier works. As usual, this is Amin, and I'm joined by our usual reread group.
Hi, this is Michael, or Mordian, on the forums.
Hey, this is Duncan, also known as Valkyrist on the forums.
And this is Zach, also known as Alias on the forums.
Perfect timing, guys.
Flawless. We didn't even practice
always,
that.
Always perfect.
Yeah, the faith is usually strong in this group.
Usually you do some sort of riddle that we all have to figure out some sort of math problem before we can.
That's right. This one I trusted you guys. I had faith in you guys, which is appropriate, I think.
We just sensed the pyramid told us what to do.
That's right. So I'm going to hand it over to Duncan again, since you've kind of been getting things going in 2020 for us with the reading list and group here. So I'll let you get our intro going.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Amin. So in this episode, we'll be reviewing two more short stories which take place in Martin's Thousand Worlds universe. They are both set in the post-interregnum period, with the major human worlds having regained contact with one another after the collapse of the Federal Empire. Both stories also focus on religion, faith, and fundamentalism. So the first story we're going to be looking at is called The Way of Cross and Dragon, which is a science fiction novelette by Martin, first published in the June 1979 issue of Omni magazine. It takes place in Findi space and is set on the planet of Arion. And it's about a priest of the Interstellar Catholic Church of Earth who is investigating a sect that reveres Judas Iscariot. Martin writes in his introductory notes for Dream Songs that the story was inspired by his Catholic upbringing and education. As a child, he would often wonder what the religion would become in the future after space travel and interplanetary colonization had been realized. So, how many dragons should we go with? How many dragons would we give The Way of Cross and Dragon?
I would give it 3.75 dragons out of 5. I thought it was a solid story. I probably enjoyed it more out of the two short stories we're reviewing today. But I think ultimately I enjoyed maybe more the views that just learning about Martin's views on religion and philosophy more than the story itself, which was more of a means to get those views out there. But I still enjoyed the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything Amin just said. I'd say probably 4 possibly real earth dragons out of 5. For very much the same reasons. It wasn't really that much of a story. I enjoyed the setting a lot. I liked the characters. You know, the plot is sort of thin on the ground and more of an opportunity for philosophical meanderings.
Yeah, I'd give it about the same. I'd give it 4. I had a lot of fun reading this one, and I think it is a very simple story, but it comes across really well. The idea that it's kind of talking about is very well considered, and I thought the characters played off each other really well, and it just was a fun read. So yeah, I'd give it 4.
Yeah, it was very simple, I think, but generally effective. I do agree the message almost was prioritized over the characters. I thought the psychological and philosophical conflicts in the story were really interesting, and I did find myself thinking about them a lot afterwards. I think it echoes some of Martin's other stories, such as Bitterblooms, perhaps, in which he shows the tension between our need for truth and beauty and meaning and how those things often contradict each other. But I think this one goes even further. I also liked that it was a science fiction work, but it showed how an old religion could be just as important in the future as technology, because often science fiction is all about technology, and it implies that we've done away with superstition. But I think, in fact, religion would survive and adapt to technological advancements.
Yeah. It's kind of
sorry, did I actually give it a score? Sorry. I would give it 4 dragons.
4 dragons out of 5. Well, I think what George does, one of the things that he does here is, like, if you have certain ideas you want to get out there, one way is to if you write about philosophy, is go write a paper, get a peer reviewed, spend all that effort doing that, or you just write a story and get it out there. So I think he went that means of getting the same thing out there and getting discussion on views, right? So that's the other way of getting things out there, is just to dress it up in a story.
Yeah, yeah, which is sort of the point I think he's saying, like the medium is just as important as the content. It's the way you tell a story that actually gives it like purpose in people's lives. It helps it like people, them, like a religion has to be like preached by the believers themselves in order to survive. So it has to like take root in people. It has to be exciting or imaginative. It has to be imagistic. So I think that's what the retcon or the reimagining of the Christian story in this story did. It was imaginative. It became interesting and something you that sounds exciting that you'd want to read. And it was done with art. So again, the medium is just as important as the message, I think, is what Martin is showing.
Well, it has to be adaptive as well. I mean, there's different ways that religion could handle all these aliens coming into the picture. And this one, at least this religion has allowed them to join eventually, right? And that, and even, in fact, that's one of the guy is superior to him is an alien.
Yeah, and they mentioned something about telepathy. Like they had killed people who were practicing telepathy because they considered it heretical. But obviously, telepathy isn't necessarily discussed in the Bible. It was just something that's been adapted through scripture or things like that. And it's like it just has to deal with new things that were never encountered in the Bible and try and figure out what to do with them.
It reminds me of Night Flyers when I think there was talk of people being persecuted for being telepaths, depending on the world and what views were there. So yeah. this church is against them.
And in fact, I think it was the same planet, because this planet starts on Vess, and I think the mother of Night Flyers came from Vess as well. So it might be like a bit of a religious stronghold.
Hmm.
I did think it was notable that, and this is mentioned early in the story, that one of Damien's captains is a non-believer, and they're still allowed to be in this order. And that's kind of a thing that...
I think that's his ship captain. I think she's in the order. I think she's just a hired...
Yeah, but as far as like operating within the confines of the system, right, like she is allowed to be a part of whatever this process of executing against heresies is. Like, if this was like I didn't really get the feeling that this was like a truly dogmatic order that was like totally against any sort of non-believer, but this is kind of the idea that comes across at the end of the story. It's very kind of utilitarian, right? Like, they just have this purpose and they're going to do it. And even like the actual archbishop guy at the end even says, when Damien says that he has a loss of faith, like, I don't care. Like, it doesn't matter that you believe or not. You just need to do the job. You know, that's what matters. So it's a little bit different than what we'll talk about with the other story, which is much more of like a purely fanatical faith system that is like to the bone. Like, we'll follow whatever strictures.
I think that's a good point,
because atheists would be considered just as heretical, if not more heretical, than people who had different interpretations of scripture. So it's more that they're against people who are like trying to muscle in on their territory, whereas atheists aren't in their wheelhouse, so they don't care as much. So it is weirdly corporate in a way. They don't see atheists as a threat.
Well, I mean, it's not that they don't necessarily see atheists as a threat, right? But that he's not working for an atheistical purpose, right? He's still doing the job, you know, that is, like, assuming that the religion is correct, right? That the, whatever it's called, the Interstellar Catholic Church is correct, right? Like, he's still, from the archbishop's perspective, right? I mean, he's still working for a holy purpose, even if his faith has lapsed, right? Whereas if he were, even if somebody was a believer, but was working for an atheistical purpose, then that would be a problem, right? I mean, it is utilitarian for sure. And I think definitely it has like the, I'm trying to think of the word, not quite corrupt, but like old, decadent isn't exactly quite right either, but just sort of it's not a fiery fanatical faith, right? Like, it's an old faith that is capable of accepting that people aren't always exactly what you'd want them to be, and they're trying to deal with problems that are actually problems and that are actually, you know, causing them problems, as opposed to problems that are just like, you know, this is an internal, like, this is in your own head. It's between you and your confessor. And like, obviously, I hope that everything works out all right. But it's not something that actually threatens like the body of the church.
It sort of shows the disconnect between the religious institution and what it's actually communicating, which is this set of beliefs. Like, those things don't always have to be in harmony. The institution is about power and governance and domination. The set of beliefs is something that's almost just personal. That's just between you and God. What we care about is power.
Yeah, it's kind of like a very honest take on like what was happening, like what led to, of course, the Reformation and all these spawnings of different forms of Christianity because of the corruption in the church and the ways they were taking advantage of it. But here they're like, yeah, that's what we do, you know. this is what we're about. Yeah, we want to take advantage of our position and execute it however we see fit, and we acknowledge that in a very clear way.
They seem to be fairly wealthy, though. Like, I mean, in terms of, at least they even said, Lucas himself says that I could have been richer if I'd stayed with you guys. And they have money and they have power in some planets.
Yeah, Damien seems to throw a lot of cash around whenever he's handling a heresy. I did just want to say, like, I mean, while I do agree with you guys that I think probably the picture that Martin is painting is of a somewhat corrupt church that perhaps doesn't actually, you know, that perhaps the leaders of it don't actually care and are protecting their power more than they're doing anything else. I think that you could have a person who does think that the message is important, right, and who wants to convert people and who wants people to believe the correct thing because they think that that belief will, you know, take people to heaven, it will save people, right? Mm-hmm. And that I think you could have a person who's a true believer and who is trying to increase the reach of the church for true believer reasons, but who's willing to use people who don't believe, right? Mm-hmm. Who would be willing to take the, you know, the Father Inquisitor and say, yeah, I mean, that's too bad. I'm sorry you've lost your faith, but you help the church, right? You spread the correct message, and I want you to keep doing it whether you believe or not.
I find that one of the things that was interesting early on in the story is talking to his superior, who's Cathane, and they're kind of comparing humans and Cathanes. Like, humans move in and out of faith easily, whereas Cathanes are stubborn. They either have a faith or don't have one, but what they stick to, they seem to stick to it more than humans do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely I think a thing in a lot of science fiction, which is that I feel like humans are often more malleable than aliens. Aliens often tend to be much more, you know, dogmatic one way or the other, whereas like humans are the human trait is always our adaptability and changeability and stuff like that.
It's a good point. It's kind of the way that, because of the nature of science fiction being constructed as humans being the natural protagonist, because we understand the way a human thinks, like a human is naturally going to be more willing to absorb new information, whereas like an alien is this like very established thing where they have all their culture in place and they're not going to be the same kind of like receptive to new things because they've just figured it out apparently before this point. Yeah, I think that does tend to happen a lot in all kinds of science fiction.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, it is a human religion, so it's going to be a lot more malleable or understandable to humans who have grown up as that, as being like a template of their civilization. Like, all of the messages in a major human religion are going to be like seeped into all aspects of culture and lore and society that have formed human civilization. Whereas they might be foreign ideas. Like, even thinking about the character or this sort of archetypal figure of like the savior or the martyr or the betrayer, like the idea of Judas being like this character who is inseparable from the concept of betrayal in human civilization. Even just that touchstone is going to be a foreign idea to a different species or alien species. But to us, it's like if you call someone a Judas, that's inseparable from a snake or a betrayer.
Another early thing on is the mention of the thousand worlds, like the actual kind of informal name of this universe here.
We get a title drop?
Yeah.
So the actual story of Judas and the dragons, like Judas riding the dragon around and burning after Jesus dies and coming back, like this was amazing, of course, and really amusing to read. But I think it kind of speaks, and of course, not to try to like put too much thoughts into like how George R. R. Martin thinks, but like it speaks to me of like this conception of this myth, like of all these myths, that are like held in such a high regard, right? Like it's even mentioned the story, like the whole story about like being eaten by the whale. Like they're held to this high regard because they're like part of this huge religious structure that's important and needs to be protected. But when you separate them from that, they're just kind of silly stories, right? They're like any kind of other weird, silly story that someone would construct. And I think that's what Martin is trying to get across when he gives Judas the dragon. It's like it's just another form of fantasy in a way, like all these mythic origin stories for different religious systems.
Yeah, and another character points out it's no less silly than a person surviving in the belly of a whale. And there's mythical creatures in the Old Testament. They talk about, I can't remember exactly, but even the dragon, I think, is mentioned, or it's synonymous with like the devil. The devil is often described of in terms of a dragon or a great serpent or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like that there's something, some dragon thing in Revelation or something, maybe. I'm not sure, but
yeah.
Well, Lucas says that it's good if you work the dragons in. You should work the dragons into your story. It's they're entertaining, which is what George did in Ice and Fire as well. He was convinced to it wasn't his idea maybe originally, or his friend had convinced them to do so there.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a bit of a World of Ice and Fire vibe with this whole story, like the way he was, this kind of Targaryen vibe where he goes and he gets pissed off and like starts rampaging with the dragons.
Judas is the rogue prince.
I was doing a bit of reading, and I found out there was actually a Gospel of Judas. I don't know if it was written by, couldn't have been written by him, but I guess it was written about him. And it suggested something different, which is that Judas had been told by Jesus to betray him or give him away to the Romans, because the crucifixion and resurrection was like a vital part of Jesus's mission, which is kind of true. Like you can't have Christianity without the betrayal. Judas plays like a key role in the quote unquote miracle of the resurrection. But it was presented to the church, but it was dismissed as heretical and whatnot. Hmm. So it kind of, this story kind of has some basis in historical, Vatican law. But there were no dragons in that version, I don't think.
Yes, although I mean that's kind of the way that it seemed to initially be something like that. Oh, they're just going to have a different view of it, and they actually believe it. But then you get to the point where Lucas says, "Like, no, I just made up the whole thing for a different purpose." That's a bit of a. Initially, it seemed maybe this was just a different true believer type thing. But no, it's actually this guy and this whole liar thing, this whole liar conspiracy. If we can go into that.
So am I crazy, or are liars basically authors? Like they're creators of fiction, right?
Yeah.
Essentially. So like he's like, this is his metaphor for what he does, what Martin does.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's basically right. I mean, like creators of all kinds, right? I mean, they had, there was sort of an allusion to the Keats thing, you know, beauty is truth and truth is beauty, except, you know, saying the opposite, that beauty is the opposite of truth. And so, like, sort of creators and artists of all kinds are, I think, the capital L liars, giving us something beautiful to believe instead of the harshness of the truth.
It's ambiguous, though, because sometimes an idea is difficult to express literally, and that's something that philosophers have always been talking about since Plato. Like Plato's always gone on about how you can never actually get to truth. Truth is something that's inaccessible to us. All you can do is kind of describe shadows or reflections of what is actually reality. Because again, humans are bound by both the sensations that we're capable of experiencing, you know, seeing, touching, things like that. There's all these sensations that we just don't have access to, but also our field of knowledge, our upbringing, all these things inform the way we see the world. Like, and it would be impossible to shed all those things. It doesn't mean you can't try, but you'd have to shed everything that you've been taught and conditioned to believe in to have any kind of access to truth. So in a way, fiction, mythology, beauty, paintings, the idea of allegory, the idea of the dragon representing something, is kind of a way to get to truth. So fantasy is a way of like symbolizing something that you can't literally have access to. So I don't think it's entirely contradictory that fiction couldn't give you access to truth.
And this is something I think, and I may have mentioned this on the last cast, but like for me, what I understand science fiction to be about, or what it's useful for, is it's a way to kind of access an understanding of where we're at in the world now, where we're at today, in a way that isn't too shocking or too painful to look at, because we have that distance from it. So you might explore some of the ideas of like just the ways that we live life in a very robotic zombie-like way by making a zombie apocalypse story, right? Where you can kind of get away from it a little bit and explore these themes in a way that's not too harsh. So like in a way, like you can, you, it's impossible to like see the face of God to stare directly at it without going blind. But if you have this kind of mirror, this dark mirror that you can look at it, it's actually possible to kind of see it clearly without going insane.
Yeah, and I think I do a lot of research into horror, and that's one of the things I noticed about different periods of history that certain types of horror films became very popular. And even in recent history, in the early 21st century, when we had the Iraq War, the War on Terror, whatnot, there were lots of movies about that subject, about the Iraq War, that were being released in theaters, but they were incredibly unpopular. Nobody wanted to go see these films, but horror films about torture, about zombies, exploded in popularity. So it's kind of like people were sublimating all of their anxieties about the reality and putting it into fiction in order to process it.
Exactly, yeah. And there's a lot to parse here, like about this notion that's explored when Luke is talking about it of like, it's great. It's awesome if you're able to believe in something, right? It's awesome if you're able to have true faith in something because that protects you from the horrors of life. Like life, if you are looking at it clearly and you understand what it's like, is just awful. Like acknowledging that this is a finite thing and you're going to die and you're going to stop existing forever is a lot scarier than believing there's an afterlife, right? So if you can truly, honestly believe that, you're going to be happy. And what else matters really in life than being happy, right? Like that's all that you're really going to try to achieve. So I thought that was a really profound point and something like I think a lot about personally. But yeah, it's like in a way, if you're with the liars, like is your version of that, like your ability to love fiction and to believe in fiction and to believe in storytelling and stories, like is that Martin's version of faith in a way?
Just a couple points there, Zach. First, you were talking about science fiction being a way to look at something maybe controversial, but without directly going on it. Like, I mean, the shows like Star Trek were like that when they first started, right? They dealt with very controversial social issues, but they were able to get around it that way. And then in terms of immersion and reading, I didn't think about that actually initially when I read this, when you're talking about like just reading, even just like works like Ice and Fire, you like to kind of immerse yourself and forget that it's just all made up by a single writer. And then you don't like the things that take you out of it. Like you don't like when there's too many references. I mean, like George had a reference to like a bet he made with somebody in Dance of Dragons. He put in like this whole thing with this bet from this guy from Montreal. And that kind of takes away from the experience when you, for me anyway, when I see something like that, too many inside jokes or references to obvious in life things takes away from the immersion.
Yeah.
But back to Lucas here. I mean, even Lucas has a few fundamental points that he says are like faith is required. He says there's some things that cannot be proven. We believe that life is worth living, and we like, he can't prove that, but he wants to believe that, and the rest is just a means to that core principle.
Right. And you have to, if you're successful in life, you have found some reason why it is worth living. And for some, that might be a faith in a higher power and the sort of certainty that life will not, life has leading to something, right? Like that there's some reason why you exist. And for some people, like, and I think this is kind of what he is getting at, is like, for some people, belief in stories and belief in the sort of like a life affirming power of stories. And I think this is kind of like what that famous line from Jojen, the reader lives a thousand lives line, is about too, is this idea that like your life is just fuller if you live other lives too, and you can do that in a way that is like honest and true in whatever way that's possible.
Mm. It also reminds me of the Tyrion line where he says, death is so final, but life is full of possibilities. Because you're right, if you look at like the truth of the cosmos and the way that Lucian describes the truth of the universe is petrifying. You can't find meaning there in a way. And a lot of existential philosophers would say, well, the only logical thing to do is kill yourself. There's no point. But at the end of the day, it's like, well, maybe I can't find meaning, but maybe if I start with the supposition that I can't necessarily prove at this point, but there is meaning, and maybe I'll try and find meaning, that anything can happen. And there's probably plenty of points in history where people looked around and said, there's no hope. There's no way we can get out of this. If you're stuck in the middle of the plague and you look around, everyone is dying, there's no way you can survive, and you might not survive. But maybe things you can do, things you can write, things you can teach your children, they will live on after you're dead. So it's like, okay, if you just look at yourself alone in the universe, maybe there is no hope. But maybe you can do things that will have meaning beyond your own flesh. And that sort of I guess that's one of the ideas that religion tries to say. It's like, it's a collective action. It's a collective meaning and narrative that we keep teaching to the next person. And that goes the same with fiction, you know, anything, art, anything. That's a way that meaning can persist beyond the individual.
Yeah, and I think Lucian's, I just kept saying Lucas. I guess that fits more to this faith thing than Lucian, but he's a voice point for Martin, I think, here. Like, I mean, something Martin realized, I think a lot of historians have realized, is that, I mean, nihilism, you can't build a society in nihilism. It's not going to survive. So it needs, whether religion or some other philosophy is there, something is needed if you want your society to survive. Otherwise, it will just collapse. And that's what Lucian is trying to do here. And he's using faith here for the method, but he's talking about ideas and philosophies, etc.
It's like you have to build it on a substance that isn't sound until you can find a sound substance to replace it with.
Well, he doesn't, he's not even sure. I mean, he says maybe it's at some point there'll be one view that can replace everything, but he's not even sure about that.
Mm.
How do you guys interpret the ending when, of course, Damien has the loss of faith, but he chooses at the end to name his ship Dragon? Is that like a happy ending of him like choosing to believe in that, or what is going on there?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because he seems to come to some realization about his relationship to Christianity, but says, but I'll still seek truth. So to me, it's kind of like, okay, he's not going to change at this point. He's still going to just keep doing the mission of the church, but he's come to a realization about himself that may eventually lead to some kind of, it's like his experiences on Arion have laid bare his actual role as a weaver of lies. And I don't know if he might still think it's worth it. Like, he might say, okay, I am lying, but at the end of the day, more good comes out of this than bad, or I'm going to do it in a way that more good comes out of, or maybe he's just on a journey. Maybe he hasn't come to a destination yet. He's just like, I see a part of the world that was previously hidden to me, and now I'm going to see where it takes me.
Do you think he thinks of himself as a capital L liar at the end?
Maybe, yeah.
He might. I don't know.
I think he does. I mean, if you look, second to last sentence is exactly that, is it not? Like, he's accepting what Lucian told him.
Yeah, which is ironic in a way, because it suggests that the liar's mission was a success. He talks towards the end about how he eventually dismantled this religion and forced the head honcho to flee the planet. But at the end of the day, this seed was still implanted in him that might end up making him a key part of this secret order.
Yeah.
A couple other big points that kind of lead into the next story. One is Lucian's talking about how religion and how it can help a society, but then when it can eventually go against the society and not be of use anymore if it doesn't adapt, right? It can get into an extremist form. And he's talking about how, like, this religion will fit Arion pretty well because it fits the people there. But I think this theme goes on to the next story for sure. Like, something will continue, how a religion can adapt or not adapt.
Yeah, it's almost like the liars see themselves as, like, shepherds for religion. Like, they herd religion. Mm. They kill a religion if it gets too destructive. They correct it if it needs correcting. Or not even just religion, any kind of mass grand narrative, economic narratives, social narratives, historical narratives, national narratives. These are all big theories about how the world exists in a way that give people meaning.
Suicide rate decreased by a third on that place since the order was growing, right? Like, you can see the tangible effects there.
I mean, that's one of those interesting little things where it's like, I mean, you know, whatever, it's a story, so I mean, it's not a newspaper report or anything, but I did sort of stop and I was like, oh, what was it before? You know, right? Yeah. If it was, you know, one person per thousand, it's one of those things where it's like, wait, was there like a terrible suicide epidemic and now it's like dropped dramatically, or was it not really a problem before and so a one-third decrease is not a big deal? I don't know. Anyway, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, that's not the point of the story.
Well, this faith doesn't cause too much harm there, right, compared to the faith of Damien. He's like, this faith fits the people here.
It'd be interesting to compare this story to A Song for Lyre, which is also about a planet where there's mass suicide rates. But that is explored in the characters. Why are these alien species committing suicide? And they see it as a good. They see it as like a joining to each other. But that's another story that deals with religion.
Another interesting point is Martin talking about the combined computer system, like all the schools and universities are connected, like the internet, essentially, and then how they go and they scrub the internet of this faith. They're like purging from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, just the fact that, like, you know, that the scholars of that world were resistant and were like, yes. Ah, this is a doctrinal fight or whatever. But they, like, you know, they came up with sources from non-Christian planets and stuff. And eventually, like, you know, I like that. Like, that was just such a nice, I don't know, it was like the system working. Like, obviously only working because, you know, the church was spending a ton of money making it work. But still, like, the peer review or whatever, like, the academic system working, right? Like, presented with enough evidence, they were like, ah, I see, yes, our archives are mistaken when we will correct them. You know, I like that.
It almost looks like Wikipedia, like, when people have to do, like, change things.
Right,
like show others. Sources or something, right? So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, my view is that he did become a liar by then. That's the whole, I mean, John was a telepath, right? The guy, he read him, that he was very close to becoming that. Although, I mean, you could see how he could have gone the other way. I mean, the guy in Robin, A Song for Lie, I think, was tempted to go one way, and then he's like, no, I'm just going to go keep searching and search for the truth. So, but I think in this story, Damien did become a liar.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the question, right, is so you reach that step in being a liar where you realize there is no truth, right? That's the first step. The next step is, can you find peace in that? Like, can you construct your own form of happiness, which seemingly the other liars have been able to do, but has he at this point? I think that's probably more so a question that he hasn't yet solved.
I mean, I don't know that the liars necessarily have to construct a truth that they find. Well, I guess, I mean, like, the common truth that all of the liars subscribe to is that it is worth it's worth trying to make people happy, that happiness has value,
right? Agreed.
And so I think that he does believe that, probably. I think that, you know, like, I mean, it's mentioned and, you know, it's implied and mentioned a few different times. So, I mean, he's not a cruel man. You know, like, he has, as he said, like, he had participated in, you know, pogroms or cleansings or whatever of psionically gifted people. And, you know, but he felt bad about them, right? I mean, like, he's not a cruel person. I think that he does probably.
Yeah, I guess the question now is, like, if he is still forced to work within this order, is he able to reconcile that with his new way of thinking? Like, mm-hmm. if he is still forced to execute those pogroms and all these other awful things.
Well, he might not do that anymore. I mean, exactly. The idea that he's going to be...
Because he seems to be
to protect people,
right?
Yeah, he has that choice, I guess.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think at his current rank and the kinds of duties that he seems to be assigned, I think he can more or less operate independently.
And that could have been part of John's plan in the first place. That, like, it's worth risking this to get one of these guys on our side, and then the ship.
All right, that's his long game he's playing.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was a relatively, I can't remember the numbers now off the top of my head, it was a relatively small planet, right? Like 9 million people or something like that on Arian?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not you know, an enormous, I mean, not tiny or anything, but not an enormous planet. And yeah, having somebody, you know, a church inquisitor, probably a relatively powerful get for the Liars Guild or whatever.
Should we look at Duncan's list of questions, see if we missed anything? There, I'm looking at your document.
Yeah. Exercising creepiness. I wasn't sure what he meant by that.
Yeah, I think you might not be here right at this moment.
Yeah, I think
I was wondering about that.
Oh, do you take for a break? Okay, well, we wait for a second and okay. Pretty much wrap up and move on to the next story. He gets back. I think maybe he's talking creepiness is the fetus, or not a fetus, like the creepiness is the guy in the jar, right? It's like
yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I was summoned by the little fish man. Sorry. The only other thing I was going to add was when the lady was talking about how this particular story is no less fanciful than the New Testament or the Old Testament, it reminded me a bit of our discussion of In the House of the Worm and the fact that that religion seems so weird and creepy and gory, the idea of the priest who has his limbs lopped off in order to embody the worm.
Right.
But then it reminds me of, like, I was raised a Catholic and we would go to church and every Sunday we would dress up in nice clothes and go to mass. And I would look up and see this guy nailed to a cross, thorn stuck in his head, blood and gore pouring down his body. Like, in a way, it was very strange to see such a graphic, gory image. But we thought nothing of it. It was just church. So we don't see some of the weird aspects of our own faith until it's presented until it's mirrored in another faith.
Yeah, And it's like, I can't think of, is it Ray Bradbury? I can't remember. But there's some sci-fi short story, I think by somebody fairly famous, where it's like, there's like, you know, a reverse Jesus, right? It's a god, a godhead who devours the followers, right? But it's all like, all the language is very similar to like the, you know, this is my body, take it and eat it, you know, all the Catholic kind of. You know, we eat the body of Christ, which is also super weird, right? But yeah, there's like, I think it's Ray Bradbury short story where it's, you know, a religion that has done made it the opposite, which is obviously like monstrous and terrifying, but like they keep all the same language from the, you know, the Catholic liturgy or whatever, but reverse it.
And a lot of the best horror stories take a lot of their ideas from Christian ritual. Again, like the idea of eating the body, eating the blood. It's very vampiric. Right, the idea of the resurrection. It's very zombie-like. The nailing to the cross, the torture, all that stuff is taken directly from antique religious mythology.
I did want to ask you guys, and we talked a little bit about this, but since I am the newbie as far as Thousand Worlds, are there any other links to other stories you guys noticed? I saw the name Vindi, which shows up in both of these two stories, but anything else that you guys saw?
New Rome,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, New Rome, Vess. I think I mentioned it appears in Nightflyer. It's mentioned in Nightflyer's Celia's World. I think he mentioned that as one of the planets he goes to study on. I think that's mentioned in a few other ones. So nothing too specific, just general.
Gotcha.
Like I don't even think the Catholic Church, the Interstellar Catholic Church, is mentioned in any of the other stories.
No, but indirectly they are. They were still around. They were around at the time of the war starting. That's the whole point of the Steel Angels, right? As we'll get to. So this kind of confirms that. Like they were around and then they're still around now in this.
Yeah.
Is that what we're saying? That this is basically just for the eventual this is the eventual form of the Catholic Church. Like they have popes and it all became this. They adapted. And they're really big in numbers.
I think so, yeah, because they have the Pope in New Rome. And they mention, you know, there's 100 other sects. So you can imagine there are Protestants and Lutherans and all these other variations that have emerged from Earth and then intergalactic time. But the Catholic Church still seems to be on top of the Christian racket.
Hmm. And then they have the guy has the webbed hands as well, so he's a merman. No, just okay. Okay, so I guess that's it for this one. We can move on to the next.
Yeah, I think that's everything.
Good.
So the next story we're going to be looking at is, let me just scroll down. It's called "And Seven Times Never Kill Man!" And it's a science fiction novelette by Martin, first published in the July 1975 issue of Analog Science Fiction and Fact magazine. It is set on the Jambles planet of Corlys. And it's about a conflict between the pacifist tribes of the Jainshi and an invading militant religious sect called the Steel Angels. In the introductory notes of Dream Songs, Martin writes that the concept of the Steel Angels was inspired by the book Dorsai by Gordon R. Dixon, while the term came from the song Star Spangled Bummer by Chris Christopherson. So how many pyramids would you give And Seven Times Never Kill Man?
I'd give it 3 out of 5. I thought it was an okay story, but I got more out of maybe what it provided in information about the Thousand Worlds and the backgrounds in the story itself. It wasn't particularly interesting to me, but still worth reviewing and reading.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess I'm similar. I guess I'll say 3 blasted apart, destroyed pyramids probably as well. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's also sort of similar. I mean, like it's a longer, story, and sort of a more traditional story in the sense of having more of a plot or more of a traditional plot. But at the same time, maybe too, like it's also, I mean, it's also a very simple story, a very sort of obvious story, right? Of like an invading force and, you know, a cruel invading force, and then the native population, the quote unquote primitive population, having some sort of, you know, secret weapon, secret power that breaks the invading force after, you know, their cruelty has completely gotten out of hand. I don't know. Maybe it was less of a cliche when it was written initially, but
right. Yeah, I think I'm gonna be a little hard on this one too. I'd probably give it a 2 pyramids. I think Yeah, I didn't really like any of the characters in it. Like, there was no one I was really drawn to, or no one whose motivations I really understood in a clear way, and I was, like, really into their journey in a way. And I thought, like you say, Michael, like, it's a very, I don't know, it's kind of like the Fern Gully thing, kind of. It's just not as interesting of a world to me. Yeah. Just was less engaging to me. There were little parts in it I really liked, but yeah, I just was not having as much of a good time reading it as the other one.
Also, yeah, definitely not a good time story.
Yeah, I think I liked it a bit more than you guys. I thought I liked the writing, and I thought it was an interesting twist on the colonists versus the indigenous people story. I thought that I found the blind ruthlessness of the Steel Angels genuinely frightening. Mm. Like many of Martin's work, I found it had a strong sort of anti-war, anti-religion message. And I think being written in the 1970s, I think a lot of the political and social distress of Vietnam War is keenly felt in the text. I struggled a bit with the shifting perspectives. It felt like the story and the message was often more important than the characters. But overall, I thought it was strong, so I'll give it 3.5 pyramids.
Yeah, but I'm not convinced that Martin's necessarily... I mean, he's an atheist himself, but he's not necessarily anti-religion as works, but anti-religion when it goes wrong, like when it doesn't help society or when it's extremist.
I think that dogmatic faith.
Dogmatic faith. I mean, faiths that are not harming the society they're in, I don't think he's necessarily against. I think he can see the value of it. But this one certainly is not. This one has served this role. But what's interesting about the Steel Knights and Bacchylon is, well, how did it originate? It originated when the Double Wars started with the Harangans and the Finni. Right. And humanity was in really bad shape there. Like, they could have easily been wiped out. And this source's religion essentially was like one of the ways that they fought that war, right? Mm. It helped them win that war, and maybe without it they would have lost. So it played a role for that period, but now it's served this use, and now it's just going on committing atrocities everywhere. So it's done what Lucan has said, it's not functioning society anymore.
Yeah, it's an example of a narrative or a belief in something helping you overcome terrible odds. Which is, it kind of shows some of the merit of religion as discussed in the previous story, but then this is an example of it going far too far and just festering and hardening people's hearts. And yeah, I think in terms of the mythology of the Thousand Worlds, it opens up a lot. And I think it gives an interesting example of the way particular sections of humanity have been corrupted or corroded by the events of the Double War and how that's pervaded into the current societies.
Right. There's that explicit mention. That's kind of the reason why the Steel Angels and their militant faith gave rise was because of that conflict. They mentioned the Sons of Franga and the Horde of Findi in kind of their origin text of it. So I'm curious with that, is Bacchylon like a character? Is that somebody who occurs in other places?
No, but Bacchylon is the god that they worship.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there was someone that was drawn from, right? Like that they took.
Not that I am aware of. I think I've read all the stories, and I think it is just a mythical figure. I don't know if it's based on a particular person. I think it's more just a vision of a male child. I see what you're saying,
Zach, though. I mean, like, you could say that initially there may have been some young guy,
right,
that picked up a phaser or something, a laser.
That's
and
what I was fighting, thinking, right?
And then it became this mythology specific. Came later. It could have been like somehow some child-looking guy. A cherub.
Exactly, like the just this image of the child with the weapon, like it just felt like it might have been drawn from like an actual thing that happened, and they distorted it and turned it into a myth of some kind. But I was just curious if that occurred anywhere else in the stories, but I guess not.
No, I don't think so. It's quite an eerie image, though. Just the idea of a child being a sort of call to violence and a call to slaughter.
He's so ruthless. He says like, you guys have. You've beaten your swords in the plowshares, like screw, like shame on you. You need to make them back into swords, and you'd be too peaceful.
I should point out the Pale Child doesn't appear as a character in another story, but it is mentioned a few times in A Song of Ice and Fire.
I was about to say, yeah,
it's like the only. We were talking last episode about whether there was any if Song of Ice and Fire took place in the Thousand Worlds universe, and there doesn't seem to be any explicit mention, but little bits and pieces of the mythology of the Steel Angels keep popping up in A Song of Ice and Fire, and I've got a list of the mentions. In A Feast for Crows, Arya Stark notices the statue of a pale infant with a sword in the House of Black and White, and then afterwards she learns that the statue is named Bacchylon and it's commonly visited by soldiers. There's mentions in two of the Winds of Winter preview chapter, which I won't explain, but they're mentioned there. And also in Fire and Blood, it's mentioned that Princess Leia Rogar of Lys, the wife of Prince Viserys Targaryen, rejects the gods of Westeros and continues to worship only Lyseni gods, such as, quote, the pale child Bacchalon of the sword and faceless Sagel, the giver of pain.
This is also a silly one, but the Proctor also says a pretty particular line. He says, "Winter is coming."
That's right.
Yeah, maybe which might be the first time that phrase is written by George.
Yeah, but I mean, we talked about this, I think, last time or in previous episodes. If George wants to, he can easily place the world in like Ice and Fire in this universe if he wants to. I think it'd be a mistake. That's up to him if he does so. But I mean, you could just as easily say that George liked the imagery of he came up with this. He's like, "Oh, I came up with this cool idea of a." A kid with a sword. Yeah. I was going to use it over and over again. And he references other people who are orcs as well, right?
Yeah, that's what I think. I think he's just recycling a cool image that he used in a previous work. I don't think he's literally suggesting that he place in the same universe. And if he was, that wouldn't necessarily be the figure to use because it's mythology even in Thousand Worlds. It's not like this character literally exists. It's just a nod to a previous work.
I'd agree with that. I think he just has certain images he likes to go back to. And I think we see some of that here with the, again, like the snow imagery that we got in Bitter Blooms and the blue fires and things like that. And there's even like a white knife river in this.
Yes, there is. So I remember highlighting that. Yeah.
So these kind of things he likes, just these images and these descriptions of things that I think he just is part of his writing style.
Yeah, and even the conflict between the Jainshi and the Steel Angels strongly evokes some of the historical conflicts in A Song of Ice and Fire. Like the Jainshi could be the Children of the Forest. The Steel Angels could be the Andals or the First Men. Andals are described as these Steel Knights. And a bit like the First Men, the children are defeated through combat, but eventually kind of take over the spiritual beliefs of the First Men and sort of envelop them into their sort of nature worship.
Yeah, I think they even had golden eyes, I think. And it really did remind me of the Andals in particular, like the fact that they were so dogmatic and violent and wanted to put them down. Like it just those guys that, you know, that tattooed the or even like carved the star into their arms, right? Like the Andalors, it reminded me of that. So the Steel Knights or the Children of Bacchalon, it's kind of like the opposite of what the church did in the other story where they encountered aliens and they eventually decide, okay, we'll bring them into the faith. Here they said, no, aliens are just nothing. Like they're just animals. Only humans have souls. They've taken that viewpoint here and embraced that, which with that viewpoint was possibly useful. It was useful when they were fighting the Harangians and the Findi. But it's not helping humanity now.
Yeah, the interesting twist on it, though, is this idea that they're not actually like going to kill off these natives. Mm. They just want to wipe out their religious figures, their idols, which are the pyramids. Like that's all they care about, seemingly. And of course, they do end up like hanging. Like that's the first image we get is they hang them up on the walls if they need to. But like it's not like this like desire to exterminate them or anything for the most part. So that's an interesting complication.
Basically they just want to move them off the land, right? I mean, like their philosophy is that they're animals, right? And so it's just sort of like shoo, you know. We're farming this area now. Please leave.
They view them as feral hogs, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
We view feral hogs in like America. They view that they say they have no souls or whatever. But yeah, they're not actually trying to systematically wipe them out. That being said, they're being no matter what their view is, they're being extremely cruel and inhumane, right? To destroy them.
It's a very sort of colonialist project. It's the idea they have to be dehumanized in order to rationalize taking their land, killing them. The idea of destroying religious icons was practiced in colonialism and in warfare as a way to like demoralize the population.
That's a good point. I mean, only very rarely, and perhaps only individually, do people like. You know, accept somebody has value and then, you know, wipe them out or kill them. They have to dehumanize them first. Like that happens with
the dehumanized invasion or anything.
Or else you'd be killing people and that would be bad.
And that's that the legacy of racism. A lot of the sort of the writing about racism, eugenics, comes from colonialism. Like they had to manufacture a lot of these ideologies about subhumans and genetics and all these things in order to justify territorial acquisition and expansion.
Right. Yeah, that's all totally true. I think for me, like the part that I just found strange is like in some of the encounters we do get where they are taking out these pyramids is like, it feels like in those cases, it may have just been the particular commanders leading those efforts. Like they were very deliberately trying not to kill them. Like they were, there was like a, it felt to me like a deliberate, intentional effort. Whereas like if it was a traditional form of that, I think they would just be like, if they're causing problems for us, why not just kill them off? You know, like if they're making this more difficult than it need be, why not just kill them? Like it felt a little different in some cases.
There certainly was some people in the Steel Knights that were trying to avoid killing people or even there's one guy that said just to stop this, not worth it. Let's focus on doing elsewhere. Like there was a variety of kind of approach there, I think.
Yeah, and there was a bit of a mirror between the two characters of the trader, whose name is Necrol, and the weapons master, I think. So Necrol's trying to encourage the pacifist Jainshi to fight, to make war, and then the weapons master, ironically, is trying to convince the warlike Steel Angels to kind of avoid conflict. And in both cases,
which is so antithetical to their belief system, right?
Like, yeah.
A part of it is literally like it's blasphemous not to be holding a weapon. That is part of, like that's just wrong.
But I think the key line here is in Bakalan's name, we must assert our dominion over them. So when it comes to things like the Harangans, they're just too dangerous to be allowed to live. They must be killed. But then they don't say kill everything because that defeats, they have to assert their dominion over the rest of them.
It's funny, I think, though, and maybe this is some of the frustration with the story, that a lot of what those two characters do is basically pointless. They don't really change the narrative. Like the Jainshi do what they're always going to do and the Steel Angels do what they're always going to do. And it's just these two forces clashing. Necrol really doesn't do anything. He has no real role in the story other than as a viewpoint.
That actually reminds me of some stories of Isaac Asimov, where essentially he had a view about history just happens and there's certain periods or things that happen. One phase goes to another, and then these certain characters try to do stuff, and it turns out it didn't matter. Like, it would happen anyway. It was just, this is what's going to happen. This society is going to run into this society, and either one's going to wipe the other one, or one's going to maybe subsume the other one and take elements into it. Like, it's just, these individuals didn't matter so much.
I was interested in the godless Jainshi that Necrol ends up hanging out with, and the ways that like once the icon for them is lost, like it completely changes their behavior. Like I was interested in that concept, and I thought there was some interesting stuff there, but it didn't feel like it was fully kind of explored, like what that means and how you're going to behave. But they do end up, some of them do end up, even after Necrol, I think he dies right at the end, and they end up going to is it Jameson's world after that?
Yeah. That's like the closest civilization.
So they have some kind of like autonomy and purpose beyond the crazy shit that everyone else is doing on this planet once they lose the faith, which is interesting.
Well, once the Jainshi lose it, a lot of them go, it's bad on most of them, right? Either they go feral, essentially, like for most of them.
They were saying. I mean, it wasn't clear. I mean, I think I can't remember who said that they go feral. Was that the trader, or was that the?
I think it was the trader said. They appear more and more
feral. It's always one of those things where it's hard to, you know, like a non-native viewpoint.
You trust the viewpoint, or maybe he doesn't have the knowledge.
Right.
The point is, like, they had population imbalance, and like it seemed like they were going to have too much population now. Like they
yeah, I mean, it seemed like. Well. Right. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, I guess I don't really know for sure what was going on. I mean, maybe I missed some obvious things, but I mean, it kind of seems like the gods or whatever is in those pyramids is essentially, I mean, like it seems almost like a, not a hive mind, but like a, you know, like some sort of, you know, psi entity that basically controls them, right? I mean, like the way they, you know, don't eat anything until like the population starts getting out of hand, and the way that you know, the escaped or not escaped, I guess, but the refugee people from destroyed pyramids either become feral, or like the ones taken in by the traitor, you know, have no actual memory of no understanding of what they were doing or why, you know.
And that's how the at the end the pyramid is able to conjure the image of Bakalan, because it maybe reaches into their mind and pulls that out. Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then it, you know, essentially is having them kill themselves, you know.
Well, it seems the weird thing, no matter what it is, it seems psi. I don't know if it that, what my question is it collective Jainshi? Is it something else that's been put there? Is something to do with the Harangans? Whatever it is, it's psi based. it seems.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's Psy, and I mean, it seems... I don't know. It seems like arguably as bad as the knights or whatever, right? I mean, it's essentially, you know, I mean, it's not harming the natives or whatever, but I mean, it is essentially running them, right? I mean, it's treating them like, you know, cattle or something, right? Like it's running their lives.
Yeah, I didn't really understand the ending. I mean, I understand what happened, but I couldn't understand what caused that pale child to appear, which is what makes it all the more sort of scary and weirds you out. Like you could say it was literally magic or spiritual or something unexplainable happened in which the pale child appeared at the sort of center of the Steel Angels coalition. Like that was the god that they worshipped, therefore it sort of manifested in this place, in this pyramid, because that was the religion that was most concentrated at that point in the planet. But that's not a satisfactory scientific explanation. So it could be the Psy, it could be the psychic energy or powers of the Jianshi or the Bitter Speaker. I think what's interesting is though, like that was part of the cause in which kind of makes the Steel Angels go crazy when they start killing their own children and burning their crops. Like that's part of it. But I also think the other part of it is the Steel Angels are so militaristic. They're so destructive, so ruthless, so violent that when they have no one else to kill or subjugate, they have inevitably turn against themselves. Like that kind of militarism combined with dogmatism, it inevitably like corrupts the person that is projecting it.
Yeah, it's kind of eats away. Enemies or heretics, you will just keep looking within your own circle. Like you're a sword that needs something to fight. You have something. You give somebody a sword and you put it in a hand, they're going to want to use it.
Yeah, the violence directed at others inevitably is spiritually directed at yourself. That kind of thing.
I mean, from a literary perspective, I suppose that's probably true, but. From like a what actually happened in the plot perspective, I mean, I think that they're getting murdered by a native Psy creature, right? I mean,
they're doing it themselves, aren't they? They're killing their
own. They're being controlled. Like they're something has taken over their minds and is causing them to slowly kill themselves, right? I mean, like whether I mean, I think there's a question about, you know, whether it actually whether I mean, like Amin, I think, was suggesting, and it's I think it's a reasonable thought that the Bacalan statue perhaps didn't even physically transform, right? That it's just you know, reaching into their minds to create the image of the statue.
Yeah, I think that's what I was wondering about that.
Right?
I guess I've read it. Maybe I misread it, because what I thought was their psychic energy had produced the image. But the Steel Angels had just seen that image and did what was natural to them. But you're saying they're literally being controlled or their thoughts are being manipulated.
Right. In the same way that I think that the natives are essentially being manipulated. Right. I mean, like they're not living independently. I mean, we see that when their pyramids are destroyed. Right. They either go feral or, you know, the ones that are taken in by the traitor essentially learn, you know, I guess human, for lack of a better, you know, whatever. Lack of a better term, learn human behaviors, right? Because now they have, because they have brains, right? They can use them if they're not being, you know, controlled by a Psy creature that's essentially limiting their ability to think and make independent decisions. Mm-hmm. But when they're living near their pyramids, like they're not making independent decisions, right? They're not living independently. They're living as part of essentially as the appendages of, you know, some sort of Psy thing. So anyway, so Michael, I find the pyramid somewhat malevolent.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I'm just curious then, why do you think that the ways they influence the two species are different? So with the Jianshi, they make them more pacifistic. And with the Steel Angels, they kind of accelerate and just increase the violence. So why is that? Like, why is the approach different?
I mean, who knows for sure? I mean, I don't. I mean, obviously, we have nothing from their perspective, and so it's hard to say.
That's fair enough.
But I mean, it's quite possible that you know, like if you think of them as some sort of, you know, as a god or as, you know, something. I always like in science fiction, you know, where you have a creature that can influence the minds of other, like, I think pretty rarely do you actually get the perspective of the thing that can influence minds. Mm-hmm. But when you do, they are often, like, especially if it's natural to them, they often, you know, don't think that there's anything immoral about what they're doing, right? Like, they can reach into somebody's mind the same way that, like, we can open our hand, right? And so they don't think they're doing anything wrong. And so to them, like, you know, it might be as simple as like, oh, I like these little, you know, these fuzzy monkey creatures. Like they're nice, right? Yeah. Like they don't hurt people and they're cute and I like them. And so why don't I, you know, create this little society for them where they get to, you know, have sex in the trees all the time. And then these outsiders come in and kill some of the Psi creatures, maybe, right? I mean, they destroy these pyramids. So these outsiders come in, destroy these pyramids, potentially killing some of the Psi creatures, at the very least, are disrupting these little colonies of fun little furry people. And so, you know, they're mad about them. They're like, well, okay, I guess we'll kill these. Like, these guys are jerks. Like, let's get rid of them. Like, I don't like them here. You know?
Yeah, I guess what I'm wondering is, like, maybe the extent of the power of the mind pyramids is to, like, amplify the already existing attitudes of whatever creature they're affecting. But maybe, like, there's no reason to believe that Jane Shear are naturally pacifistic. So maybe that there's no credibility to that. But at least on the side of the Steel Angels.
They seem not to be naturally pacifistic.
Right, exactly. Right?
So they turn feral and learn, you know, human behaviors.
Right. So there's no reason to believe, like, that's the state that's the state they would be drawing from. So, yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure.
The idea initially, this discussion earlier, because the Proctor is getting visions and the guy says, oh, maybe the Harangans had the soul sucks or whatever to give you false visions. Like the idea of false visions is placed there. It just seems to me that what's odd about it is, like, you think that would also be bad for the Genchi, but they seem to be helped by this. So it's not really, I mean, you could say, okay, they're being controlled, but if you compare what they were without it. On average, right? They weren't in a very good state. Like they seem more animal. Like they seem just chimps, essentially. Like the way they're acting, like being violent and
Only because they weren't, you know, given the freedom to form their own societies, right? Like who knows what kind of society they could have formed if they had been left to do so, right? Because I mean, obviously they are intelligent, you know. I mean, like when they are, you know, exposed to, you know, culture from, you know, Jameson's colony via the trader whose name I can't remember. You know, they seem to adapt to it pretty well. Right. You know,
that's interesting. Well, I guess you could view it then that it is something Harangan based where it was just the goal is to keep pacify and control. And the Jainshi were controlled and the humans were not easily controlled. So they just decided to eliminate them instead.
Yeah, that's possible. Sure.
Because those visions, the guy's actually having visions. Like he burns his stuff because he has a vision. Like that doesn't make sense. Like when he burn his summer store, he's like, oh, because his winter store is because summer's coming.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, and he was clearly like, you know, I mean, to some degree, I mean, that's a fair point, right? Like to some degree, it may be that people, maybe everybody, but maybe especially, you know, fanatical people have some degree of resistance, right? And so, like, they slowly, you know, over time, over that first winter, like, they worked on his mind and he prayed and they worked on his mind and they worked on his mind. And then they showed him the signs that they promised him and then showed him the big sign that he took into his, you know, because, like, proximity might play a role in it too, right? Like, so they could influence him somewhat.
Well, so proximity does make a role in Psi, right? Doesn't it? I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Gravity
right.
And
often.
Proximity.
Yeah, often. And so then they get them to, you know, like a Trojan horse, right? Like they get him to take the Bakalun statue into the walled compound, and then at that point it's, you know, close enough to everybody to be powerful enough.
Pyramids
to...
are basically satellites, I think, or transmitters.
Sure. Yeah.
It might
you
not
could
be
think
the
of it
being
that way.
Itself or the.
Yeah, that's
the
a good point. Right. They could just be. Yeah. It could be a single being. Yeah. Right. That's just that uses the pyramids as amplifiers or whatever.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially because they bring up the soul sucks. I was kind of wondering what if the Jainshi were the soul sucks? What if they were the original enemies of humanity, but now that the Harangans are gone, they just form their own societies. But I don't know.
Interesting.
There's probably plenty of species who have those abilities.
Well, what's interesting about it, I mean, he wanted to give the weapon to the Jainshi, like, elder, and then he went and consulted, like, with the pyramid or prayed to the gods and said, that's not the way to do it or something. Or, like, it seemed like there was whatever's there or had another plan or another route, right?
Exactly.
Fighting with weapons was not going to work. You're just going to get wiped out.
Which does bear out, right? Because they are effectively pacified or dealt with because they start killing themselves.
Well, the Jainshi are ultimately right. They say, no, we'll just wait. Our gods will help us. And essentially...
And they did.
Their gods did deal with the problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
It reminds me a bit, actually, of the Nathi, the fact that, like, people would try and take over the island, and then one day they would just get really sick from the butterflies and die off. So it's like, in a way, that they're pacifists because they've just been taught, but from experience, that if anyone tries to take over, eventually they'll be able to just take over the minds of the colonizers, or they'll go crazy and kill each other, or they'll just, die out. So there's a way of fighting their enemies that their enemies don't understand. The enemy is understanding technology and force and violence, but they don't understand, like mind control and things like that.
And the line you talked about, Duncan, earlier about like the first men adapting and joining a faith. I mean, that's kind of the last sentence is that essentially, right? It's in thousand woods, the Jinshi are praying, and then in that city they're praying. They're all kind of converted to this local faith, or this forms of this local faith.
Yeah, I think that's what I really liked about this story. Like the fact that the Jinshi originally just seem like cute, cuddly teddy bears that you're sympathetic towards, because these big scary men are coming to hunt them. And then by the end of it, like you're really freaked out by what they're capable of.
Well, I mean, they're Wookiees. That's something I was going to bring up, because I read an article. This story actually had, I think I read it years ago and I forgot about it, but I remember the title, because there's articles back to 2010 at least, where essentially people, I think they make a fairly good argument saying that the artwork, anyway, for the story inspired Wookiees, because it came a year before Star Wars, I think. And if you look at the artwork for Chewbacca and the cover for this book, it's like very similar.
It is, especially with the ammunition.
Which is funny, because most of them don't carry weapons, right? It's just the physical characteristic was used for the Wookiees, like, as inspiration, because that's what they would do. Like, if they're making some random sci-fi movie, they might look at a bunch of art everywhere and say, oh, that looks cool, use that.
I think it's very possible, because it was 75, I think, the story came out. And then I think some of the people who wrote the article pointed out that the original designs of Chewbacca were very different, and then they changed. They were like hairless. It was this hairless creature, like more like an alien looking thing, and then it became more like a big teddy bear. for a redraft. So 75 was this story with the cover, and then 77 was Star Wars released. And I think it's very possible that an artist, creating costumes for a science fiction movie would have seen a copy of Analog, or would read Analog.
Yeah, those guys are nerds. But, of course, they're reading this.
Like the amount of science fiction, short story collections would have been only a dozen or so back then. So it's very possible.
Who are the guys that are on the Return of the Jedi? Those little ones. Like the little guys?
Ewoks.
Yeah. When I read Jinshi, I saw more Ewoks than Wookiees, though, in terms of size. I don't remember if the size is described. Wookiees is what the artist that drew it for Martin's work drew a large character, and then that was used. But they seem small to me, like children in the forest.
And I think the Ewoks were originally meant to be Wookiees. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be a planet of Wookiees, but they changed it to save money, I guess, on costumes.
Or to get more kids.
There's supposed to be a whole part in the first Star Wars movie where, like, they went and did all this stuff, but that was all cut.
Yeah.
And we eventually get some of that Return of the Jedi.
But I think
Wookiees in the Star Wars Christmas movie or something? Or there's a
there is, yes.
Life Day. Happy Life Day. But I think it's interesting, like, the Ewoks, in fact, are a bit similar, a bit closer to what you imagine the Jinshi would be, and it's a very similar setup, like this technologically advanced stormtroopers invading this very technological primitive army of teddy bears. The Ewoks are far less pacifist than the Jinshi, it seems, but they overpower them by their knowledge of the land through more primitive tactics. And again, I think Lucas has even stated that the Battle of Endor was meant to be an allegory for the Vietnam War. It was a primitive army versus a technological advanced army, and the technologically advanced army was creamed. Well, not creamed, I shouldn't say that, but it was eventually worn down and had to withdraw.
Logs beat ATSTs.
Every time.
why use lasers? Just use logs. They're more effective.
I wanted to ask, so of course I know it's drawn from that song that you mentioned, Duncan, but what do you guys think the title of this story means relative to the story? Because I have no idea. Like, I have no idea what it's supposed to indicate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a cool line. I think, what was the whole passage? So it's, you may kill yourselves and your mates and your cubs as you need, and you can, but kill not for pleasure, and seven times never kill man. And it's from Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book.
I mean, I don't know. I guess the one thing that I took, right, is that it's saying don't kill man, right? Like, man is a special category, and that's the whole thing with the, you know, the Backloon people. I don't know why I can't think of what they're called.
Steel Angels.
I want to call them the Knights. Steel Angels. There you go. Thank you. That's their whole thing, right? Like, everything is an animal or a man. And in the Jungle Book seems to be, the Kipling thing seems to be making the same point, right? Like, animals are different than man, right? Like, don't kill man. And and the Steel Angels are wrong, right? Like, what is a man is sort of, I mean, it's not like, I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear, right? It's not like a philosophical discussion in the story, you know, like, obviously the Steel Angels are wrong. And, you know, and the natives could easily should be considered, you know, men in the sense of, you know, sapient creatures. So that's what I assumed was that it was just about, like, what is a man versus what is an animal.
Gotcha.
Well, the interesting thing with the Steel Angels, I mean, they don't like Nakral, but they don't want to kill him unless, like, he gets in their way, because he's still considered to have a soul or whatever. And then they also react heavily when one of theirs is killed by the Jianshi, right? That's what really pushes them to killing all these Jianshi.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The idea of what constitutes a man or a human is a very different context between the Jungle Book and this sort of science fiction universe. I think the idea of killing for pleasure, the sort of ruthlessness and the brutality and the sadism of the Steel Angels evokes this killing for pleasure. Killing to dominate and subjugate rather than because they need to survive. But I was, I did do a little bit of research about the story, and I confess I watched the Preston Jacobs review of this, this story, which was actually quite good. It wasn't particularly conspiratorial. It was more just a straight review or analysis of the story. And he brought up a really good point about the quote from Rudyard Kipling, which was that the Jungle Book, and in fact, a lot of Kipling's work, has strong themes of British colonialism. There's allegories read into the Jungle Book, and in general, you know, Kipling's White Man's Burden poem is often seen as a justification for intervention in other countries for humanitarian purposes. And I think in this context, it's quite interesting because obviously Kipling's work was set against the backdrop of British empire, whereas Martin is writing in the era of American empire and against the backdrop of Vietnam and incursions in all these countries to stem the tide of communism and things like that. So I think I definitely read the Steel Angels as more in that line of like American imperialism, American militarism, that kind of thing. So I think that's maybe where part of the inspiration from the quote comes from, that this is American violence and intervention that Martin is kind of framing his text around in his parable.
I buy it.
That's interesting because the Steel, I mean, if you go follow that analogy, I mean, the American military anyway was needed in the World Wars, right? Especially World War II, it was needed. And then maybe you could say that maybe it went too far at times, right? It was going over abroad and going to Vietnam and so forth. But the America withdrawing of the world was not needed. Like, it didn't help at that time, right? Like, it was needed in World War II.
Oh, absolutely. American industry, whatnot. But then you see how far that can go when you get to, like, nuclear technology, and it becomes a bit more ambiguous what is right and wrong.
There's this great line at the start, this idea that it's one of the Jianshi characters basically saying, like, that he did not believe in evil because, like, evil is like a concept of faith that he didn't have. It's the traitor character, like the other traitor character or something. And he essentially says he learns what evil is because of these Steel Angels. Like, that idea that, like, evil is like a for evil to be necessary, you have to have belief in something. So I don't know, that's just interesting to think about relative to all this.
Yeah. Evil is like almost a higher calling in a way than just, you know, selfishness or exploitation. Evil requires like a project of suffering and cruelty, like a long-term project.
And relative to all this stuff with World War II and the ways that escalated is it was very clear, like, we need to defeat the evil, you know, we need to defeat the evil in the world. But then when you keep seeking evil, it can go too far.
Yeah, and that's interesting, I think, because if you look at the origin stories of the Steel Angels, there was a very clear evil that needed to be defeated. The Hrangans and the Findis were attacking them, so they got to operate their violence from a position of feeling victimized and feeling righteous. And now, I guess, if we follow on with the Vietnam War allegory, now America is in a position of power. the Steel Angels are in a position of power. Now they're fighting. They're the invaders. They're the people victimizing the weaker, yeah, or the weaker people.
Become evil.
The destroyer of worlds.
Yeah, something like that. It's a little tenuous.
So I liked all that kind of big imagery and big kind of, yeah, I don't know. All those big ideas were quite compelling, I thought.
One last point on my end and one question. Just a point, we talked about earlier, but the Elder specifically says, not only, like, but we deal with them, it says, if they come, our God shall speak to them. Like, shall speak to them, right? So he's correct. Not only deal with them, but, like, interact with them. But one question in terms of the statues, the Jainshi themselves starts carving the Bakalan statues, and it seemed to be implied maybe the traitor gave them info to one of them, but then there was many of them being made. Like, does that also maybe somehow they're being communicated by a sigh or by distance? Because it seemed to be there was more than one place making those statues, like the Jainshi.
Yeah, right. I agree. There's something, something is reading him and figuring out what it is that he thinks art should be like, and then giving it to him, right? And that's why it looks fake to real art collectors, right? Because it's not from something alien, right? It's actually, yes. it's you know, through a mirror darkly or whatever, from his brain of like what native art should be like, or what primitive art should be like.
As far as the Thousand World stuff, quick, there's a mention of Tomas Chang, a legendary Avalonian linguist, whatever that is, which I guess is some kind of understander of languages. But is that a name that appears anywhere else, or is that just a...
Not Thomas Chung, but Thomas Chung worked for Chlorotomus, who is a really important character, and he's mentioned in a few of the stories. He was mentioned in Bitter Blooms last episode. And he did during the interregnum, he was sent out by Avalon to conduct a survey along with a bunch of other ships, a survey of the galaxy. Three ships never came back. Two of them came back after a limited survey, whereas Chlorotomus like basically voyaged for years and tried to reconnect with all these other sort of isolated human worlds. And one of the worlds he came across was Corlys. And his linguists interacted with the Jainshi, and they developed a way to understand them. So that was one of the encounters that Chlorotomus has. And next episode, we'll learn a lot more about Chlorotomus.
Actually, one final point I forgot to bring up, because we kind of all jumped over Nekral's death. We didn't care much about him. He was trying to help. Like he was a hero. Like, he was trying to help people, and he was not a fighter. He could barely move. He was trying to help these people, and then he dies. Mm. And then they make a doll of him or whatever, a statue, like they carve something.
A shroud.
And because it has it's almost like the tribute of a widow or a child. And it's like, it seems like, okay, now is there going to be like these Jainshi that are leaving the world? Is Nekral going to become like a messiah or a character for them, like the pale child was? Like, is this the birth of a new religion or something, if you go with that? Because they're leaving the world now, like the pregnant Jainshi.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. So everything else carved was kind of like godlike, like they were gods or they read. So it was kind of interesting. Okay, so what do we have coming up next, Duncan, for the next episode?
Yes, so the next episode we'll be reviewing The Glass Flower and The Stone City. And unlike most Thousand World stories, these texts are set far away from human civilization and deal with distant alien cultures. And they're also two stories which I think benefit most from having a bit of background knowledge about the Thousand World setting. So I think it's good to have a few stories under your belt before you read them. So yeah, we'll be doing that next time.
Cool.
Love those titles.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me, guys. It's a pleasure as always.
Yeah, it was good to have you.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. And check us out on Bastards of Kingsgrave .wordpress.com, on the forums at Podcast Fast and Fire. And we'll see you next time.
Bye bye.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.
Just in terms of where we're going, I guess we have that episode coming, and then maybe some other episode, kind of catch some of the short stories we missed in the Thousand Worlds. And then I think we're done pretty much, other than I don't think we actually ever formally reviewed Haviland Tuff works on here, but that's kind of a project of its own because it's got a bunch of short stories.
Yeah, I would like to read. Yeah, I need to read it. I think I've read one of the stories and I really liked it. Yeah. And it was quite funny. It was much lighter than these other stories.
They're good.
Nice. Yeah, they kind of, yeah, they go back and forth. Some of them are lighter and some of them are a little darker.
Yeah.
That could be a series of a couple episodes. Like you can kind of like one or two of them at a time. Chip away at them.
So Duncan, for these two stories you mentioned, having that context is useful. Is there any particular like stories that would be helpful to have read?
Not necessarily. I think just getting a sense of like the background that this world, I think this is a good story actually to have, and Seven Times Never Kill Man, just to know that there was a big war, there was kind of a collapse of the empire, and then basically these worlds are coming back together. The glass flower deals with Chloronymous. He's like a central figure in that story, so it's kind of good to know him as a bit of a mythic figure beforehand.
Right.
And the Stone City is quite good. I'm actually looking forward to rereading it because the first time I read it years ago, I haven't reread it, I had no idea what was going on. It's one of the weirdest, most surreal stories.
Okay.
But it sort of casually mentions lots of aspects of the universe. It mentions Harangans. It mentions a few species that have been mentioned in stories. So Nightflyers mentions like the Findi, the Dimush. You actually get to meet them in this story, so it's kind of good. It's kind of cool, I think, to hear about these aliens first, and then meet them. It's not vital, but I think the Stone City in particular is a hard one to follow. But I'm looking forward to rereading it because I think I've figured out a few things that happened in that story subsequently. So hopefully I'll be able to follow it.
Yeah, well, that's why I like doing this part of it, because you guys help me understand what's happening.
I think Martin had said that story was meant to be a bit surrealist. Like, it's quite weird, a lot of the things that happens. Mm. Like, it's inspired by Kafka and Lovecraft, I think, that story.
Cool.
Okay, I'll let you know if I need the audio. I think my audio is going to work.
Yeah,
okay.
Sounds good.
Thanks, man.
See you guys.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, see you guys.
Have a good one.
Stay safe. Bye. Bye.
Hey guys.
Hello.
How you doing?
Doing pretty good. Hey everybody.
Hey guys.
Cool, we got everyone here then?
Looks like it.
Yep. I don't think Amber responded, so she might not have had a chance to read.
Yeah, that's fine. I just look at this. Do you guys have a preference for which story we start talking about? Of the two, like in the order?
No, I don't care.
No, it's fine either way.
Yeah, not especially.
Okay, could we start with the cross story first?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I kind of feel like chatting about that first and then getting to the second story, I don't know, it kind of leads well into the second story, the way I was reading the two of them.
Understandable.
Okay, get my recorder open here. Is anyone else recording?
Yes.
Mine seems to be running, yeah.
Good.
Sweet. Yeah, mine too.
Nice.
Okay. Everybody is.
I'll do our usual intro and then hand it over to Duncan again, since you're, I'm guessing you have a bit of intros for each story, or?
Yeah, quick one.
Cool. okay, we good to go?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay, here goes.
Mm-hmm.